We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the program. Kyle Mabry is at the controls this morning. In the early days of the automobile, vehicles powered by gasoline shared the road with those powered by electricity. In fact, says our guest, science writer Seth Fletcher, electric cars had a strong early advantage. Certainly one advantage that electricity has over one disadvantage, I should say, that electricity has compared with gasoline is portability. Gasoline, well, you can put it in a little can and you can put it in your trunk and take it with you. Electricity, that's a little bit more complicated. It's all about the battery. In fact, if you take a look at the history of battery development over time, at least in the last 100 years, it is very closely associated with the car and the idea that electricity could be a good way of powering a car. There are a lot of people who think that electric cars may be able to recapture the advantage that they once had, these early advantages, as the result of advances in battery design. So that's what we'll be talking about in this part of our show, this part of Focus. Seth Fletcher is a senior editor at Popular Science magazine. His writing has also appeared in various other places, Men's Journal, Outside, Salon, other publications. And he is the author of a newly published book. The title of his book is Bottled Lightning, Super Batteries, Electric Cars, and the New Lithium Economy. Hill and Wang is the publisher, and the book is out now. And we'll be talking about the subject here in this hour, and questions are certainly welcome. Folks who are listening are welcome with questions. We just ask people to try and keep them on the topic and try and be brief so we can get as many callers in as possible. But certainly you can give us a call or you can send us an email. 333-9455 is the telephone number for Champaign Urbana. We have a toll-free line that's good anywhere you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So if it's a long-distance call, use that one. And then we also have email, will-talk@illinois.edu. You want to use that, you can send your question that way. In any case, any point here, we're up for your questions and comments. And Mr. Fletcher, hello.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Now, how are you?
Thanks. Good. Thanks for having
me. Well, thanks very much for being with us. And I guess maybe one place to we could begin talking, and it is interesting to note, as you do in the book, if you look back to the early history of the automobile, there was a time when, in addition to cars, autos powered by gasoline, we had steam cars. Maybe people will remember the steamer. And there also were electric cars, and all three of those were on the road at the same time. And in fact, at that point, as you say, the electric car actually had some positives to it, some advantages that the others didn't have. So what happened?
Well, let me see where to start with this. Yeah, well, you know, when the automobiles began, when it first emerged, it was primarily an urban transportation device, and around the city, electric cars were clean, they were reliable, they were easy to start. Gas engines were very difficult. You had to start them with this hand crank, which would backfire and sometimes break arms. They were loud and dirty. And but what eventually happened was that gas cars got much better, and then the one sort of insurmountable obstacle that the electric car couldn't overcome was range limitation. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as people got a taste for driving, touring, as they called it, outside of the city, going out into the country for long distances, they could fill up a gas car by stopping at the general store and getting a tin of gasoline. They could do it very quickly. Electric cars, if you ran out of juice in the middle of the country, you were just stuck. And then Charles Kettering invented the automatic starter. Gas cars eventually became incredibly convenient, and electric cars became stigmatized as sort of the wealthy old lady's car eventually, because older women decided that they stuck with them because they were clean, and gas cars became the man's car, to oversimplify. But that's really what happened.
So it seemed it was a combination of things. It was improvement in the technology. So probably building better engines. It was inventing the electric starter, so you didn't have to do that hand cranking thing. And then, then there's the issue that's really still that plagues the electric car today, really, and that is the how far you can go on a charge.
Yep, that's absolutely correct. And then the charging time is. The corollary to that is that it takes so long to charge. You know, if you could charge one of these in 15 minutes from any wall outlet, it wouldn't be that big a deal. But it takes several hours minimum to charge an electric car. And people are working on fast chargers, which we can talk about later, but that's still a somewhat experimental technology and there are challenges. So that ultimately is a challenge. Yeah, I mean, America is a country for long-haul driving, and people like to be able to go as far as they want and fill up at any gas station. That's sort of part of our DNA.
Yeah.
I think that's been the challenge.
The other part of this, and I mentioned that I think is also interesting, is it, when you think about it, we now have around us a range of battery-powered devices, notably phones and computers. But really, if you look at the effort at least over about the last century or so, to develop better batteries, particularly rechargeables, that's really been all about trying to figure out a way to power an automobile.
It's certainly true of Thomas Edison's battery, the competition between Thomas Edison and Exide in the early days, and then that's certainly true of what happened in the late 60s and early 70s when motivated by the smog crisis in California, and well, actually not just in California, but primarily in the Los Angeles basin, and then by the oil crises of the 70s, a lot of people, material scientists, got into the business of developing new batteries, and they applied the tools and techniques that they had used by then to develop the integrated circuit and the transistor, and they a lot of them had to start very small. You know, when you're developing a battery, you use this coin cell to go into a lab and you'll just see these half-dollar things scattered everywhere. And you know, so you have to start small. But the dream that everyone always had was to find a way to make the electric car finally viable.
Yeah.
So that was the dream of those engineers, and it pushed the technology forward. It's interesting, though, because as you say, that was the goal, but what that eventually ended up yielding was the lithium-ion batteries that now power our cell phones and laptops. And only now, decades later, are we finally getting to a point where we're beginning to put those batteries into larger devices, cars.
Yeah. I'm sure that also the effort has been hampered by the up and down in interest, and that maybe that tracks with the up and down in price of oil over time, because there are times when people are really into this as a research topic and as a potential for commercial development, and then other times when it just doesn't have the kind of appeal. And what's really one of the things that people will read about that's really striking here, just as an example, is that the company that became the first commercial maker of rechargeable lithium-ion batteries was, wait for it, Exxon, the oil company. They actually had a scientist who worked for them, and he was able to do something other people had never been able to do, to make one of these batteries that actually worked at room temperature. This was in the early to mid-70s, during one of these times when people were really, because of oil prices, people were very excited or at least very interested in trying to develop electric cars. But then oil prices went down and we discovered some more oil, and then it just didn't seem to matter anymore.
Yeah, that's correct. Exxon in the 70s was diversifying into all kinds of businesses. I mean, they wanted to take on Xerox and IBM and office equipment, and they were working on solar, and they bought this company that made electric motors, and then they had the battery division, and it was exactly that. I mean, in this time, in the 70s, Exxon executives were giving interviews to Fortune and Forbes saying, you know, we're going to run out of oil, and it's probably inevitable that we're going to be driving around in electric cars within a couple decades, and we want to get in on that. And then it suddenly became much less urgent. I think there was some, they ended up closing during the recession at the end of the 70s. They ended up closing a lot of their expansion businesses, and then oil became cheap again, and that affected the motivation to do alternative energy, you know, electric car programs. And then they kind of never looked back. And what's interesting and kind of, what's interesting is that so much of this intellectual property was developed in the West, you know, beginning with Exxon in New Jersey, continuing with scientists in England and elsewhere. And it was sort of shelved during the 80s, but Japanese companies had a strong need for better batteries because this was the boom of consumer electronics over there, the beginning of it. And so they picked up the research and solved the remaining problems. And then in 1991, Sony came out with the lithium-ion battery that's the same basic chemistry we still use in all of our portable electronics today.
Hmm. And even now, as we're moving into trying to apply this kind of technology to different things, and the big thing here we're talking about is the car, it seems that the Asian manufacturers really dominate here. And I'm sure we'll end up talking about the Volt, the GM's plug-in hybrid. That car, they rely on a Korean manufacturer to make their batteries.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's correct. I mean, they built up the industry. I mean, they have been, you know, I don't know the exact percentage, but I'm going to say well upwards of 90% of all of the lithium-ion batteries manufactured in the world right now are manufactured in Japan, Korea, or China. Mm-hmm. And here we are. Now we're trying to build a lithium-ion battery industry essentially from scratch. And what's interesting is that still, to this day, so much of the most advanced research, basic research and intellectual property is being developed in the United States and in universities and national labs. Argonne actually has a huge lithium-ion battery program, or excuse me, not even specifically lithium-ion battery, just advanced battery program. And yet, it's still an open question whether we're going to be able to develop this industry for building batteries for electric cars.
Yeah. And that it also leads a lot of people to raise this question about dependence on foreign suppliers. People make the argument that if we could develop a good electric car, that would reduce our dependence on imported oil. But there are also people, and they put it just that same way, they say, well, we're trading one dependency for another if we end up depending on battery manufacturers in other countries.
Right. You know, that argument, I think, my biggest problem with that argument is that many people who use that argument are using it as an excuse to stick with the status quo. I mean, that's the American Petroleum Institute has latched onto that argument. You know, we're going to end up trading a dependence for oil for foreign batteries, so we might as well just stick with oil or, you know, develop oil domestically. But, you know, batteries are not oil and lithium is not oil. And I think that there's a big difference between buying batteries from Japan and, you know, buying billions of barrels of oil from elsewhere. And there are two separate issues here, which I'm sure we'll end up talking about. There's the environmental issue, and then there's the energy security issue. And they're intertwined, but you can also separate them. And as one guy who I interviewed for the book said, if you're worried about global warming, who cares whether China does it or Japan does it or Korea does it? If the United States ends up building the electric cars that the world needs, then that's great. But if not, we'll get them from somewhere else, and that will still be an environmental benefit.
Let me introduce again the guest for this hour, Seth Fletcher. He's a senior editor at Popular Science Magazine, and we're talking about his new book. The title is Bottled Lightning, Super Batteries, Electric Cars, and the New Lithium Economy. Hill and Wang is the publisher. And the book takes a look at part of it is the history of the development of the battery, particularly the rechargeable battery, but also how that's intimately connected with the drive to develop electric cars. We'll take your questions, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have some callers. We'll plunge in here. We'll start in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. I have a quick question. It's going to be kind of a two-prong here. The first part is that probably the next car that my wife and I are going to be getting is going to be some kind of a electric hybrid. And my wife is the chief researcher on the project, and I'm the one that's home today. So she called me and said, you'd ask him two things. In your opinion, what's the number one pro and the number one con of electric cars? And the second one is, after the life of the car, what do you do with it? Because it's a huge pile of toxic, you know, metals and acids, and how do you recycle the car afterwards? So the number one pro, number one con, and what do you do with the car afterward?
Okay, I'll actually start with the second one because
I'll just go ahead and hang up.
Okay, those are all excellent questions. Go ahead, Sam.
Yeah, so I'll start with the second one. That's actually a pretty common misperception that the batteries that are going into these cars are toxic, filled with toxic chemicals. They're not, actually. You know, what you have in the batteries for the Chevy Volt, I mean, there are some, you know, solvents that are kind of nasty in the electrolyte, but, you know, lithium is benign, manganese, you know, it's carbon. It's not like they're made with cadmium or lead or sulfuric acid. I mean, the batteries that are used today have been engineered over the years to be environmentally safe. And in fact, one of the things that initially drove the development of the rechargeable lithium battery in the 80s in Japan was that their landfills were filling up with mercury and cadmium from all of the batteries, from all of their consumer electronics. And, you know, it was contaminating the environment. And so that was part of the motivation for looking for safer, less toxic alternatives. The number one pro and the number one con. I think the number one pro is that depending on whether you get a plug-in hybrid, which still has a gas engine, or whether you get a Leaf, which is purely electric, I mean, the number one pro is that you're never going to use gas, or hardly ever use gas, if you drive the Volt, for example. And that's not just a money saver, something to feel smug and good about. You don't have to go to the gas station. You can fill it up at home by recharging overnight. And I think a lot of people get kind of a high out of that. I mean, you're no longer dependent on this like kind of disgusting fluid that you buy. The price is constantly fluctuating. So another pro closely linked is that electric cars are actually very fun to drive. I mean, they have immediate torque, you know, so they feel faster than they are around town. The Leaf and the Volt both are potential tire squealers. I mean, they won't drive incredibly fast. They're not sports cars, but, you know, compared to another compact hatchback, they're very, very fun to drive. They're silent. They're incredibly smooth. I think that as more people drive these cars and realize that they're not golf carts, I think that's what has to happen for these to catch on. And that's why GM, for example, has been bringing the Volt around the country to just do these local events and try to get people in them, because it really does change your perspective of what an electric car can be now that now that automakers have really committed and the technology has advanced. The number one con, I would just say that the number one con is that still limited range. I mean, and this is why the Chevy Volt is designed the way it is. It has a gas engine for backup. And, you know, it kicks in once the battery is depleted to a certain extent and just keeps the battery charged, provides electricity. So it always drives like an electric car, but, you know, after 40, 50 miles, depending on how you're driving, you're going to end up burning some gas. A lot of people are reporting that they hardly ever use any gas, particularly around town. But, you know, you could still take a road trip in the Volt. The Leaf, you couldn't. The Leaf is going to have to be either a second car, or if you live in the kind of city where you use public transportation all the time and you want to rent cars to go out of town, and you just want something that's completely gas-free for driving around town, The Leaf is a fantastic car, and it's cheaper than the Volt too. But the Leaf is limited in range, and that is a problem for some people. And then actually the other con for right now is the cost. These are more expensive. They're not ludicrously expensive. The Volt starts at roughly $41,000, $42,000, and then there's a $7,500 federal tax credit, which may eventually become a point-of-sale rebate. So it's not absurdly expensive, but it's more than you would pay for a conventional gas-powered car of the same basic shape and size.
Mm. Well, other than the price, which, again, for some people, that'd be price prohibitive, the con seems to be the thing that always has been the con about the electric car, and that is how far can you go on a charge, and then attached to that is how long does it take to charge. And as you say, depending on what kind of driving, that could work just fine for you, but, maybe not. So now the question is, because you've also looked at the efforts to develop whatever might be the next generation, the battery superior to the lithium ion battery, is the thought among scientists who work on this that there might be in the future some sort of battery design that's even better that would allow you to go further?
I think that there are two things here. One is that engineers and scientists and car makers are finding all kinds of ways to make immediate incremental improvements in what you can squeeze out of today's batteries. Some car makers are finding, GM is finding that they can probably get away with using more of the battery than they initially thought they could. They limit the amount of battery that they overbuilt the battery, basically. They built a bigger battery than they thought it needed because if it depleted or if it ran down over time, over the years, they wanted to have plenty there to still do everything that they told you the car would do initially. They're finding that the batteries are performing a little better than their conservative estimates in the beginning had, said. And so, as a result, they can probably use a smaller battery, cheaper battery, to do basically the same thing that the Volt does today. And so, those are sort of really basic engineering-style fixes. On a chemistry level, people are learning how to pack more active electrode material into the battery, which is just replacing dead space or extra weight with more active stuff. People are learning how to use new compounds. Panasonic, for example, has this new battery cell that's coming out either next year in 2013 that uses a silicon alloy for the negative electrode, which, without getting too technical, it just brings the capacity up. It's a good advance. It makes them, each cell, store about 30% more charge than what we have today. So all these things taken together, we don't need an enormous fundamental breakthrough to make electric cars a lot more practical and effective than they are today. That's going to happen just through incremental advances. But to get to the 500-mile electric car, which is that's the dream, car that you get into, you can drive 500 miles on a charge, and then you can recharge it in 15 minutes or a half hour. That's an enormous technical challenge because of the nature of batteries. But people are working on lab-scale solutions, and they're very far off, but there are some exotic chemistries such as lithium air, lithium sulfur. Depending on who you ask, these are either the next great hope or they're completely unworkable. But I think really we don't know yet whether these are unworkable, but people originally said that making a rechargeable lithium battery was unworkable, that it could never happen because lithium was too dangerous. So I think the best thing to do would be to keep supporting these scientists and not once again go into some decade-long battery science lull, because there will be breakthroughs of some kind. How fast that's going to come, I'm not sure, but there are a lot of very smart people working on this problem.
All right, let's talk with some other callers, and we have several. Next will be someone in Sycamore, in the northern part of the state. This is line two. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for your holy grail of electric car comment a moment ago. That's been my standard as well. 500 miles and charge in 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. But I'm more specifically interested in your thoughts on what every public radio listener hears on a credit that's frequently given by a railroad company claiming they can move a ton of freight 500 miles on 1 gallon of fuel. Mm-hmm. And we know that all railroads are relying on diesel-electric hybrid engines to run them,
right,
which says, oh, my God, why haven't people come out with diesel-electric hybrid cars? They can go hundreds of miles on a gallon of gas. Now, I realize the average car weighs at least a ton and a half or two, which means the 500 miles would be cut down to something like 200. But that's still a huge improvement over what we have available with vehicular technology today. So how are they doing that?
You know, I'm hesitant to get too deep into this because I'm not familiar with that specific claim. I mean, the diesel electric hybrid, the way I should actually ask my dad. He's a railroad engineer. He would be able to tell me. I suspect that that's based on momentum. Once you get something that heavy going, yeah, I'm sure you can move a ton from a stop. You know, moving a ton. And what was the statistic again? I want to write this down and check this out.
It's a credit you hear given as a sponsoring funding organization, mm-hmm, as one of the railroad companies. They're claiming they can move a ton of freight 500 miles on 1 gallon of fuel. And you bring up a very interesting point that maybe that is indeed what they're saying, is once it's rolling, that's its cruising efficiency. But if you do stopping and starting, then that number will degrade significantly. And, of course, all cars have to do that.
You know, I really want to check this out because it's fascinating. That would be my guess. I could be totally wrong. But it's not as if this technology exists and the car companies are just refusing to use it. You know, they would, I believe that they would use it. Somebody would build these cars if they could. But the limits of a passenger vehicle, you know, you have only so much space to put a battery in. You need to keep it below a certain weight, or the car will not handle well or won't handle as people expect. You need it small enough that you can fit 4 or 5 people in. You need it to be able to accelerate. You need to, you have all these things to balance. And so you have this hole, and engineers are just saying, okay, what's the best thing that we can put in that hole to make this electric car the most powerful possible? And, I haven't seen anything that suggests that there's some sort of, mystery technology that's just being withheld. And the diesel electric hybrid, that's interesting because I believe that they're set up on the series hybrid arrangement, which is the Volt, which is you have a gas engine powering an electric motor. That's not exactly how the Volt works, but I believe that diesel electric hybrids in trains work by you have a diesel engine powering a bunch of electric motors, which are down by the wheel, and that's how you get a lot of torque out of it that way. And I'm going to look this up because now I'm very curious, but I'm afraid I can't totally dissect that one for you.
Right. Well, I appreciate the question of the caller. We have some others. We're talking this morning with Seth Fletcher about his book Bottled Lightning that looks at the effort to develop the kind of batteries that make for a practical electric car. We have some other callers. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
The clock has now been started. It was officially 5 o'clock in Reykjavik. Spassky is obviously anxious about the whereabouts of Mr. Fisher.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about chess champion Bobby Fisher with filmmaker Liz Garbus and with Fisher's childhood friend Anthony Sadie. Garbus' new documentary is Bobby Fisher Against the World. Join us.
By the time 1 hour has elapsed, he forfeits the game.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Oh, there he goes now. He's just played 1.
This is Focus. It's our morning talk program. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you throughout the week. In the first hour of the program tomorrow, we will talk about the history of the Peace Corps with Stanley Meisler. He is a former deputy director of the Corps' Office of Evaluation and Research. This was in the mid 60s. He's also worked as a journalist and has a new book out that's a history of the Corps. It's titled When the World Calls. On the program also tomorrow in the 11 o'clock hour, something we do every month on the show, we welcome questions about computers. Peter Kimball will be the guest this time around. He works with the Center for Teaching Excellence at the U of I, so if you're having some problem with your computer, maybe you're thinking about buying a new one and you're not quite sure what you're doing, you can call in. On Friday, we'll talk with Susan Casey. She's an award-winning journalist, editor-in-chief of O, the Oprah magazine, and she has authored a book that's just out now in paper that's entitled The Wave, which is all about highly competitive surfers around the world. So I think that should be an interesting conversation. You can go to their website, which is will.illinois.edu, and find out what we'll be doing in the days ahead. Also, if you'd like to listen to past programs, we have a big web archive there so you can catch up on shows that you might have missed. That's will.illinois.edu. In this hour focus, we're talking with Seth Fletcher. He's a senior editor at Popular Science Magazine and is author of the new book, Bottled Lightning, which is about the effort to develop practical rechargeable batteries that can be used to power electric cars. Hill and Wang is the publisher. The book's just recently out. And we do have some other folks here to talk with. In fact, the lines are full, so we'll try to get in as many callers as we can. And we'll go next to Effingham, line four. Hello.
Yes, good program, David. Being the iconoclast that I am, I have to ask your guest, I'll keep it as short as I can, there is no such thing as perpetual motion outside of wind and water. There is no electric that's used today that is not generated by coal. So if we, there's other exceptions, but in the main it is coal. Every time someone with an electric car plugs in there for a recharge, they're not burning electric or the motion that provides motion to the vehicle. It has to be recharged, and that electricity comes basically from coal. Thank you.
Well, that's the that gets at the question, and I certainly would have raised it if a caller hadn't. What if we really had a lot of people driving electric cars? What would that do to the demand for electricity? And could we meet that demand in a way that was green?
There are a bunch of different ways to get into this question. The first thing I would say is that not all electricity is generated from coal. A lot of it is from hydroelectric and natural gas. I'm not even going to mention renewables because those are a tiny fraction, but they're growing quickly. So it's not all from coal. And studies, if you look at them, if you power an electric car from a purely from a really old, dirty coal-fired power plant, the net CO2 emissions are still a little better than gas. They're not spectacular, but that's really the worst-case scenario. If you're concerned about CO2 emissions, you're concerned about coal anyway. That's something, electric vehicles are part of a system that needs to be reinvented. If you're really concerned about carbon emissions, electric vehicles are one piece of the puzzle. And I think what's going to start happening over the coming years and decades, although I hope it happens soon, is that the dirtiest coal plants are going to end up being closed down and replaced with natural gas plants, which emit a lot less CO2 than when you charge an electric car from a natural gas plant. That, the math is much better. Even the worst case scenario, electric vehicles are slightly better from the CO2 emissions standpoint than gasoline. Now, in terms of capacity, the thing to really keep in mind is that the capacity is there, and what electric utilities will be doing and are already doing is trying to encourage people to charge overnight, off-peak. There's a ton of unused power in the grid that's being generated anyway. That coal is being burned anyway. And I have not seen a single study that says that, any reasonable number of electric vehicles hitting the road is going to require burning a whole lot more coal. If we're looking at replacing every single car in the American fleet, all 300 million some odd cars with electric vehicles. Yeah, that's a problem, but that's not going to happen for a really long time, and the grid will evolve over time. So, for the foreseeable future, there is absolutely plenty of slack in the grid to support electric vehicles. You run into problems with, if you have a cul-de-sac with an old transformer and you have two or three people who buy a Leaf or a Volt or something, that transformer will probably need replaced, which is part of the reason why utilities are trying to really closely track electric vehicle adopters so that they can replace those transformers. But that's really a local problem, not a system-wide problem.
All right, let's go to Edgewood, Illinois, for another caller. Line one. Hello?
Yes, maybe 10 years or so ago in Scientific American, there was an article about where there would be battery stations where you would drive your electric vehicle in, your spent battery would be dropped out, and a new battery would be popped in. I realize there would be some standardization issues there, but is that a viable option?
That's a point of hot debate. The guy who's really pushing that, Shai Agassi, runs a company called Better Place, and he's working very closely with government in Israel and also in Denmark to try to set up this system, and it works exactly how you described it. You drive in, it's like a drive-through car wash, basically, and a robot arm, comes and takes out your old battery, puts in a new one. The company owns the battery, you own the car. The ownership model might not be exactly like that, but it's something like that. The battery is a standardized unit that just is replaceable. They take them, recharge them, put them in the next car. The major automakers have not shown very much interest in that scheme, and I think that there are probably a couple of reasons. One of them is, as you point out, issues of standardization. Automakers want the freedom to build the most effective proprietary battery that they possibly can so that they can outcompete other automakers. But I've also heard some people who have really serious technical concerns about the viability of doing this. I think the jury is still out on whether this is technically viable. I had one guy tell me, one guy who works in electric vehicle research for Southern California Edison, that you can perform a heart transplant and the patient can live and be fine, but I'm not sure you can perform a battery transplant. And that's probably an exaggeration, since clearly some people are doing battery swaps. But it's not a paradigm that I see catching on in America anytime soon. And that's just really because the automakers have not shown interest in it here. It'll be very interesting to see how it works out in Israel in particular and in Denmark, where Better Place has these programs set up. And I guess we'll know in a few years whether it's really catching on or whether it's kind of tanking.
Okay. I thank the caller. Let's go to line three next, Urbana. Hello.
Hello. Is there any potential for the rotary engine or regenerative braking?
All of these cars have regenerative braking, so that's just a built-in part of the system, and they have different modes that use regenerative braking. You can tune it. Some of these cars that are less sophisticated, if the regenerative braking isn't blended properly, it's like, you let off the accelerator and you just lurch forward. But it's really smooth and dialed in on the Leaf and the Volt, but they count on it definitely to recharge the batteries. And in fact, in mountainous driving, the stories of people using a lot of battery to get up a hill, but then they make it all up on the way back down, leave work. If they have a downhill commute, when they get home, they'll have as much charge left or maybe even more than when they left, because they get it through regenerative braking. Rotary engines, it's another internal combustion engine. The only people using it are, as far as I know, is Mazda, and it's sort of an enthusiast thing. And they're fun cars to drive, but they're not very. My understanding is that they're not very efficient. The Mazda R8 at least does not get spectacular gas mileage. So maybe it's the RX-8. I may have misspoke. thinking Audi R8. But regenerative braking, yes. Rotary engines, I don't really see anybody talking about those having a place in this system. Mm.
So just to make sure that people understand what you're talking about, regenerative braking, essentially you have a power generation device that's attached to the wheel so that as the wheel turns, it's generating, that is the wheels of the car, it's generating power. So you could think about the example you gave. Yes, say you would use power to go up to the top of a hill, but as you were going down, you were coasting, so you didn't need to use the power of the car to go down the hill. But as you were coasting and the wheel was turning, you're recharging your battery.
Well, actually, the way it works, it's not actually a unit at the wheel. It does it at the drive shaft.
The
Volt, for example, has two. They have a large electric motor that's the primary drive motor, and then they have a small electric motor that's primarily used for regenerative braking. You know, motors. It gets complicated, but a generator and a motor are pretty close to the same thing.
All right. Okay, let's go to Champaign County, line two. Hello.
Hi, I'm testing a new hands-free. I hope I'm coming through okay. The earlier caller, I think you were right in saying it was the momentum in the right-of-way that made for the efficiency of the what he called a hybrid diesel-electric on the trains, but I was going to ask about the hybrid diesel electric that both BMW and Volkswagen apparently market in Europe, whether they have their own battery production or how many different hybrid sort of battery in factory, how much production is going in different places. The point earlier about batteries being reliant on battery manufacturers, it is the case that apparently the best lithium supplies in the world are under Bolivia and Afghanistan. So, but it's also possible, I guess, that batteries could be refurbished. I mean, lithium isn't consumed in the operation. They get less efficient, but it's the lithium is still there, and it's possible that it could be remanufactured into an excellent battery. So that's a battery of questions.
Well, yeah, okay. There's a lot there. We'll see what we can do with that.
Let me see. I think, again, I'm going to start towards the end and kind of quickly run through some things. You're right. Lithium is not consumed. It's not like gasoline. It's a metal used to make a machine that stores energy. So, you know, the analogy, you see this in the popular press a lot, saying, oh, we're going to be reliant on foreign lithium. Well, you know, it's different. It's, you know, and actually, Bolivia and Afghanistan, I mean, the lithium reserves in Afghanistan won't be exploited for, I mean, who knows how long as there's a war there. I had one person tell me that that's a story for the 22nd century. Maybe in 100 or 150 years, Afghanistan will be a different place and we'll need to get in there. Bolivia has a large deposit, but they're not developing it, or they're attempting to develop it right now, but they're actually not producing any lithium right now. The majority of the world's lithium for battery purposes comes from Chile, just right across the border in Bolivia. It's very peaceful, stable country, and I actually went down there to visit the operations of SQM, which is one of the big lithium producers, and they have a lot of excess capacity. They claim that they can supply the entire world demand if need be, and I'm based on everything I've heard, I'm inclined to believe them. Now, diesel electric hybrids, that's a really great option. I mean, because diesel engines are efficient, so if you can make that internal combustion piece of it more efficient, all the better. And the German car makers are particularly interested in diesel. They have a lot invested in diesel. So I think you'll see those combinations coming out. BMW is sort of slowly making its way into the electric car market. They tested the Mini E. They are soon coming out with a 1 Series electric called the Active E, and it's just going to be a small fleet thing, like a test fleet. But eventually they say they're going to come out with this car. It was called the Mega City vehicle. I can't remember exactly what they're calling it now, but a small commuter car that would be purely electric, and that's expected, I don't know, around 2015 or something. Volkswagen is also into this. I mean, Volkswagen, Audi, they're into this. I talked to a guy named Martin Eberhard for the book. He was one of the founders of Tesla Motors, which is the company in California that makes that awesome converted Lotus, basically. And his new job was working at Volkswagen Audi in R&D for batteries. And, you know, he really, car makers will not tell you what they have coming up in the future. You know, they keep play everything very close to the vest. But he was almost giddy with excitement, you know, when he talked about the company's plans for going electric. And I wouldn't be surprised at all to see something big come from Volkswagen in the coming years.
You know, we're coming down to the point where we have about 5 minutes, and we have a number of callers and probably won't be able to get them all. But I'm really struck how this is a subject that seems to have gotten at least a handful of people here pretty excited. And it, there's a lot of research going on. There is a car that is now available, and GM says will be available now nationwide by the end of this year, the Volt. But, you know, in the 90s, GM tried to market an electric car, the EV1, and I think a lot of people considered that to be a failure, perhaps, again, battery issues here. There was a time in the 70s, early to mid-70s, people thought there we would see a rebirth of the electric car. And also, there have been other times we can point to, not all that far back, when people thought, okay, now's really the time. Mm-hmm. Well, what makes anybody, you or anybody, think that this time now, here, 2011, is going to be any different?
That's a very, very good question, one I've wrestled with for a long time. You know, I would say that I am cautiously optimistic that this is going to stick. And the reason... Well, there are many reasons. I mean, the external reasons are that we're, you know, the Copenhagen Accord failed, and we're not going to see any climate change legislation out of the United States Congress anytime soon. But, you know, automakers work globally, and there's a big push, at least in other countries, to cut CO2 emissions. And CAFE standards here, corporate average fuel economy standards, are getting much stricter. And, you know, a gradual hybridization is going to be a key way to meet those regulations. We've also seen the volatility of the price of oil. I mean, as soon as the economy starts to rebound, oil prices go up. I don't know of anyone who thinks that oil is going to one day be a dollar a gallon again and stay that way forever, you know, without wading too far into the peak oil debate, which is a very fierce debate, there's a good chance that we will, before long, start to see serious shortages of oil. And that's a very contentious subject, which I'm not an expert on, so I'm hesitate to get into it, but a lot of people do genuinely believe that. And I think that what's really different this time is that it's a constellation of factors that drove the automakers to get into this. The EV1 was inspired by a single clean air mandate in California. And GM built the EV1 in response, but the whole time it was fighting that regulation in court. It didn't actually scrap the EV1 until it managed to weaken that regulation, which was the whole existence for the being of the car in the beginning. This time you have car makers betting billions and billions of dollars, you know, leaving GM aside for a moment because there's a lot of controversy about the bailout. Nissan, for example, has will invest something like $5 or $6 billion in its electric vehicle program by, I think, next year, 2013. That's a huge bet, and they have a purely electric car. They don't have a backup gas engine, so they're really betting that the conventional wisdom about electric vehicles, which is that they'll never catch on because they have a limited range, is just completely wrong. They're building factories all over the world. There's an incredible amount of money going into this, and I think that the amount of money going into this says to me that these car makers aren't going to want to lose this money, and I think that that's probably a much stronger motivation to gradually electrify the vehicle than any single piece of legislation was. And just all of those factors coming together make me cautiously optimistic that, you know, if things continue on course, this is probably inevitable. It's going to be a very long time before, you know, electric cars are the majority of the cars on the road, I think, even. And oil is going to be with us for decades. But I believe that this is going to stick.
Hmm. We'll try to get real quick at least one more call. Ivesdale, line one. Hello.
I'll try and be real quick with my questions. One, I have two big concerns. One, will schools and manufacturers be able to keep up with competent technicians, you know, training them to get repairs, or will you have to take a vehicle into, say, a regional area like Chicago, St. Louis, that type of thing? Will we have, is there going to be anybody at the dealer where we buy it from that we can take it to and get a competent repair? And also, another thing that I worry about with, I want to go wind power and solar. And I'm kind of waiting, hoping for better battery longevity because it's expensive repair replacement costs. And I'm wondering about battery longevity in the future, how soon we might see some developments there. Maybe you already touched on that. And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, well, thanks. And I can give you about a minute.
Okay. I'll try to whip through it quickly. There's a reason, you know, the Volt and the Leaf are available only in specific regions right now, and that's not because they want to, like, limit the number of people who can drive them, but because they're having to train technicians along the way. I mean, they want to make sure that when you buy a car, you have someone in your area who can fix it. And they want the process to be as seamless as possible, which is why they're only selling and leasing these cars in specific markets right now. So by the time it's available in your area, by the time you can go down to the dealer and buy a Volt or a Leaf, there will be a technician there who can work on it, and there will also be somebody who can help you get the charging station installed in your garage. And in terms of the longevity of the batteries, I mean, they're from a consumer standpoint, they're warrantied for 8 years, 100,000 miles. So it's not something you have to worry about for 8 years or 100,000 miles. That's the car company's problem, and they've done enough testing that they're confident issuing that warranty. And I haven't seen any technical reason why that shouldn't work. And then after the batteries, they can be used for solar and wind. They can be used for you can bundle a bunch of used car batteries together to store electricity from wind and solar, and that second life.
All right, there we'll have to leave it. If you want to read more on the subject, the book is Bottled Lightning, Super Batteries, Electric Cars, and the New Lithium Economy, published by Hill and Wang, by our guest Seth Fletcher. He's a senior editor at Popular Science Magazine, and thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.